Thank you, choir members. That was beautiful and inspiring. We're really blessed with wonderful talent and wonderful hearts to go with them. It's great for me to be back after being gone for 3 weeks. When I miss church services on the Sabbath, I really miss them. And I miss all of you. Elsie really wanted to be here today too, but she just was not quite up to it because of the time spent in driving and sitting and standing, and it would just be a little bit too much for her today. But she really wants to be back, and I'm sure she'll be back by next week. We still have some more medical tests and doctor's appointments, but it just doesn't seem like there's a sense of urgency. So we went ahead and got our plane tickets for our trip to Escondido for the feast and all. So we're not very worried about her health right now. If she does need another surgery, we hope that it's relatively minor. And it's really been inspiring the last year or two, hearing about so many miracles. I mean, we can't prove something is a miracle sometimes, but, it surely seems like it, the way things work out for people. So we hear a lot of good news. God certainly performs a lot of miracles. One miracle we feel that wasn't a healing miracle was that when Elsie was told by her doctor back during the summer that you're going to need a hysterectomy, and she says, I'm so busy, I'm so booked up, she said that my first opening is going to be in October. And Elsie says, October? Says, that would be terrible. I said, can't you work me in sooner? She says, no way, I'm absolutely booked up. And Elsie says, well, I'm going to pray about it and hope that you'll have a cancellation or some way to get me in earlier. And the surgeon chuckled and said, oh, that's cute. About 2 days later, her office called up and said, guess what, we have an opening on August 7th. So when Elsie went back for her next appointment, the surgeon shook her head and she says, well, I guess your prayers were answered. As we know, they were answered. No. It's good to see all of you here. I'm glad to see Beth Bradford. She's here on behalf of her husband. We're all praying for her husband, Larry. I'm glad to see Trevor Robinson move back to the Dallas area. And wonderful that Joyce Rodriguez has survived a major brain surgery. Cal Bone's coming along well. Lots of good news. I asked Mr. Wright if it was okay with him if I gave one of my feast sermons today. And he gave his permission, and so that's what I want to do. That's where I'll get a little practice. I'm giving two sermons at Escondido, and there are two of us. Well, there's three full-time ministers that will be at Escondido. That's Robin Weber, who's the coordinator, myself, and Joe Horchak. Well, because Phoenix, Arizona is an outlying feast site, especially for the people who can't travel in that area, so they expect nearly 200 people, I think, there at Phoenix. But anyway, he's asked Joe and myself to each fly up to Phoenix one day and bring a sermon. So one day I'm going to fly to Phoenix and back to give a sermon. Another day Joe's going to fly to Phoenix and back to give a sermon. So it will be an interesting feast, God willing. I don't think I'll turn to a lot of scriptures today because I just want to cover so many points. And these are points and principles that you're familiar with, but I want to put them all together in a special way. I hope you're getting feast fever, because I'm certainly getting feast fever. In this U.S. election year, I've had a chance to listen to a lot of great speeches. Now, would that we could solve problems as easy as we can talk about problems. But I like to listen to great speeches. The Bible says, walk with wise men and you shall be wise. And so when I listen to a wise speech, I'm hoping to become a little wiser. But what the effect of this has been on me is to really fire me up for God's kingdom. Because when I hear about the problems, I think, yeah, I know the answer. I know the solution to those problems. And that is, Christ is coming and he's going to solve it. And when I hear about good things promised, I think, well, I know who's going to really fulfill those promises. Jesus Christ is soon going to be here to fulfill great promises like that. So it's actually helped to put me into the mindset of a feast fever. And also, we're so worried about the economy right now in general as citizens of the United States. People worried about their jobs and their income and their finances and so forth. And so what I want to cover today is why the world of tomorrow will be extremely prosperous. Why the world of tomorrow will be extremely prosperous. Because it will indeed be extremely prosperous. And I don't mean by that that we're going to have a world full of rich people, because you don't need to be rich to be happy. You don't need to be rich to be content. If you have what you need and you can enjoy a variety of things and live in contentment and peace and health and happiness, you certainly don't need to be rich. But I think there's going to be almost no real poverty. And if anybody's really in poverty for a while, it's going to be his own fault. Because certainly the conditions are going to be just right for everybody to be quite comfortable if he puts his mind and muscle to it. And so Jesus said for us to pray, "Thy kingdom come, thy will be done on earth." And yes, we should pray that. And boy, this is a time to focus on that. We want the seventh millennium, that millennium that's spelled with a capital M, the millennium. We long for that to be coming very soon. Let's turn to Romans 8, beginning in verse 19. Romans 8, beginning in verse 19. This really sums up how desperately we need God's kingdom. Romans 8, verse 19, "For the earnest expectation of the creation earnestly waits for the revealing of the sons of God." And that means us, brethren, the sons and daughters of God, that God is calling to be a part of the first fruits, to be prepared to assist Jesus Christ in ruling the world. It is a responsibility beyond what we can fully appreciate. But I hope that we put our whole hearts into growing and being faithful and having patience, as we heard in the sermonette, and patiently enduring, so that we will be there in that first resurrection, and we will be ready to say, "Okay, Lord, send me. I don't know much about ruling. I don't know much of anything about being a king or a priest, but I'm ready to be taught, and I'm ready to go." Verse 20, "For the creation was subjected to futility, not willingly, but because of him who subjected it in hope." In other words, God knew that we needed to be tried and tested first under adverse circumstances. And then we had the opportunity to build character. And verse 21, "Because the creation itself also will be delivered from the bondage of corruption into the glorious liberty of the children of God." And that's one of the themes of my sermon, is liberty. This world needs to be liberated. We people need to be liberated. The greatest liberty that the world has ever known will be the liberty in the world tomorrow under Jesus Christ. Verse 22, "For we know that the whole creation groans and labors with birth pangs together until now. Not only that, but we also who have the first fruits of the Spirit, even we ourselves groan within ourselves, eagerly waiting for the adoption," or the sonship, "the redemption of our body." And to have the mind that is totally filled and led by God's Holy Spirit. And so, we human beings are very aware of how many problems there are and how much this world needs God's kingdom. But we feel real compassion for the birds and the bees and the trees and the plants and the oceans and the everything. The world itself, the creation itself, needs to be healed. And there's going to be so many changes that it's going to be a better world for everybody and everything at that time. I've traveled a little bit around the world, and I love to read about conditions in other parts of the world. And on the one hand, it seems strange that countries are burdened with so many major problems, because I believe that God has blessed all peoples with a natural intelligence. No matter what race, no matter what ethnicity, people have an amazing capacity with the brains and and the spirit that God has given each of us. And so people are very talented, intelligent, and capable, and able to learn in all parts of the world. Most parts of the world are blessed with wonderful natural resources. Most parts of the world have fertile soil. But what's the problem? Why is the world in such a terrible shape? Well, I think we can boil it down to the problems of government and religion. Government and religion. And guess what? Guess what God's people are called? What are our primary jobs under Jesus Christ? To be kings and priests. What do kings do? They take care of the government. What do priests do? They take care of the religion. The primary responsibilities we will have as the saints under Jesus Christ is to bring about good government and good, right, pure religion. The one true religion of Jesus Christ. And so, I want to talk about the problems of government and religion today, but mostly talk about the way it's going to be in the world tomorrow. You know, the very next to the last verse of the Bible, Jesus Christ says, "Truly, I am coming soon." And we need to keep that uppermost in mind. And it's interesting, right after that, John, who was writing all of that down, he added his own words then. So he added, "Yes, come, Lord Jesus." And so we too say, "Yes, bring it on. Let it come soon." For quite a number of years, I have heard many prognosticators, many people predicting the imminent fall of the United States. I mean, way, way back we started hearing people saying, well, this economy's in such bad shape, and because of this factor and this factor and this factor, you know, this economy cannot last more than 1 or 2 years. And it just cannot. I'm sure it's going to fall within that time. And so those times come and go, and we're still here. But I know why, and you know why. And that's because of God. You know, God can keep us afloat as long as He wants. I personally think this country would have collapsed before now if it were not for God. And I believe that the reason that even though things start to get bad, then they kind of pick back up and kind of improve, and we go up and down, up and down, up and down, and why we keep getting this relief and temporary improvement, is because God is intervening, because God is not through with His work, because God has more for us to do, and it's like a bubble that's getting bigger and bigger, and it's going to be a big pot someday. But God can keep that bubble full as long as He wants to. And He's in control. And I can't help but to be excited about political races to some extent. But yet I know that even though who wins a race makes a little bit of difference, that no matter what people do, we are going to collapse someday. All the prophecies are going to come true. And we need to be prepared for it, for bad times, and then we need to be prepared to rule with Jesus Christ when He returns. Yeah, Daniel 2 and Daniel 4 are two of the places which talk about how God sets in place those that He chooses. And He causes nations to rise and nations to fall. He puts in place, sometimes He puts in place a better people. Sometimes He puts in place even the lowest of people. But that's the way God, that's one of the major ways God deals with nations. But there are so many factors that are going to make the world prosperous. And so let's begin to run down the list, so to speak. We hear people being fearful of a one-world government, but of course that's exactly what we need. We need one world government under Jesus Christ. And He is coming back to establish that. And that in itself is going to bring about an instant unity. And when I talk about the peaceful conditions and unity, I'm talking about after a period of transition. Because the very first few months and years after Christ returns, He's going to be putting down rebellions, And it's going to be pretty chaotic, I imagine, for a while. So peace isn't going to be instant, but the conditions are going to be almost instant. In other words, the removal of Satan, the devil, and the demons is going to take place right away. And there'll be very rapid progress toward the peaceful, prosperous conditions. But to have one leader, one king over all the world, and to know who to look to and what the laws are, is going to make an instant difference. And it's going to be a new world. It's not going to be patching up this world. There are so many applications of that little lesson that Jesus taught. The Pharisees, when they wanted to kind of add in a little bit of what Jesus taught to what they already believed. And he says, no. He said, you don't put new wine in an old wineskin, and you don't put a new patch in an old garment. It doesn't work well. He's meaning that we need to start over from scratch. And with all the destruction taking place beforehand, that's going to pave the way for a massive rebuilding project. And it's going to be a very different world. Industry, business, education, religion, commerce, everything is going to be different. And we can really look forward to that. Just the fact that the removal of Satan and the demons in itself is going to make a huge change. Now, we know the prophecies about the change in the nature of animals, how that there will not be dangerous, predatory animals, and we won't have to be afraid of those. And we wonder how much of a change is there going to be in human nature. Well, one thing that affects human nature a lot is influences from Satan and the demons. Well, that's going to make a big change just by removing that influence. And then, of course, helping us to forget and overcome the bad habits of the past and the bad memories of the past, that will make a big change too. I don't know if there's... And then, of course, being offered the opportunity to be baptized and to receive the gift of the Holy Spirit, of course, that's a giant change. But as far as another immediate change to human nature, I don't know if there will be. But like I already said, just the removal of the evil influences of Satan and the demons and society, people will start being very different. You'll notice that throughout my sermon, I'm mostly talking about human beings and what life is going to be like for human beings. And that's always seemed a little bit amusing to me at feast time, is that we're talking about a time when you have spirit beings ruling over human beings, and what fits spirit beings is very different from what fits human beings. But the Bible tells us a whole lot more about what life is going to be like for human beings than what it's going to be like to be a spirit being. It's still kind of a mystery is what it's going to be like to be a spirit being. So my sermon, admittedly, is focusing on what it's going to be like to be a human being. And we'll leave the subject of what it will be like to be a spirit being for another sermon, of course. Think of the Olivet Prophecy and all the increasing tragedies to come upon the world. But then after Christ returns, there's going to be no false religions and no wars and violence and threats of wars and no famines and no malnutrition and undernutrition and food shortages and all that. No pestilences, no disease epidemics. No major diseases will eliminate the causes of those diseases. Even just from a financial point of view, it is no way for us to comprehend how much all of these disasters are costing us. How much more money and material things would be available to the people of this world if we weren't having to spend a huge part of the world's wealth on just dealing with emergencies and calamities and catastrophes and desolation and the horrible things that are happening. And all the weather problems. When a city loses electricity for one day, there are millions and millions of dollars lost. And that's pretty common for major metropolitan areas to lose electricity. And so just think of a world where we don't have to worry about cities losing electricity. And we don't have to worry about things being shut down. And floods getting in the way of being able to move about. And all of the many, many things. I want to switch now to talking about the role we will have as priests. And one of the major roles of priests is to educate. To educate both spiritual knowledge and just knowledge in general. Not like that we're going to teach people everything. It's not like the priests of God are going to teach reading, writing, and arithmetic. But we will teach the foundation of knowledge and certainly encourage everyone to get a good education. It is so sad that the United States right now is falling way behind many other countries in the level of education that our young people are attaining to. It is bodes very bad news for the future of this country. But partly it is a result of education being looked down upon, especially by young people. I grew up in a little town of East Texas, and I had to struggle with that because I was really caught between parents who were very pro-education and a bunch of redneck classmates who ridiculed education. And they ridiculed, you know, if you made an A or a B, you know, they made fun of you. Like, well, boy, you're really trying to be a smart person, aren't you? Boy, look at him. And so I grew up in a climate where I would try to make good grades, but I would hide the fact. And I sort of would get in a habit of acting dumb to kind of fit in because of my own insecurity. Well, that's just one example. I mean, this similar experiences are all over the place. Many young people who would otherwise be capable of being great achievers are not great achievers because that's not cool. Getting good grades, you know, learning, finishing high school and going to college and getting a good degree, that's not really cool like other things are cool. But it's going to be cool in the world tomorrow to get a good education. And it's going to be so ideal a climate in that way that that will quickly make a huge difference. Just think how different the world would be today if everybody had a good education. It would be phenomenally different. And everybody's going to be literate, will know how to read and write well, and communicate well. And then the awesome thing of having one language. Now, I think we'll still have other languages because languages are fascinating. But to have one common language where we can all speak in that common language and all understand each other and get things done and have no misunderstandings and work on projects together as teammates and not have any language misunderstandings, that is going to be so advantageous for all kinds of business and commercial activities. It's just going to be incredible. So with the education we have and the right foundation for that education based on the Bible, the whole world is going to know what is right and what is wrong. So they know how to do right. There's no be no confusion or argument about what is right and what is wrong. We're not going to waste time with investigating all kinds of theories. If a theory is out of harmony with the Bible, then forget that theory. Don't waste your time on it. And it's going to be such a blessing to do away with the theory of evolution. As Mr. Armstrong used to say, evolution. It is evil. There are so many not only direct but indirect effects of belief in evolution. It has had a fantastic, horrible effect on the world. Even such extreme things like Hitler really being in love with the theory of evolution and thinking, well, since human beings are supposed to be evolving into higher beings, let's just do away with the lower species of human beings. We'll speed up the process of evolution. So everybody we deem to be inferior, we'll just kill them and we'll be promoting evolution. The effects of evolution have been horrible and have turned people away from believing in the Bible and thinking, well, here's something else that sounds cool and scientific, and so I don't really need to bother with the Bible. That's kind of old-fashioned stuff. And so people have tended to neglect real history, and we don't learn the lessons from the past, and we keep making the same mistakes. It's like we're not content to learn from previous mistakes. We've got to make the same mistakes all over again. So we're going to go from the dark ages, the relative dark ages of ignorance, to real enlightenment. I read about the phenomenal increase in innovations and inventions that began about the beginning of 1800. Through the 1800s and through the last century, America led the world in countless new, helpful, practical inventions. Agricultural inventions, industrial inventions, transportation inventions, and on and on and on. And it was because of the free enterprise and the ingenuity of people being unleashed and feeling free to try to figure out how to solve the problems and so forth. And I believe that we're going to retain the technological knowledge we have now and add to our technological knowledge continually during the millennium. I think we are going to see an explosion of inventions, and we're going to move on to greater and greater things in that way. Now, at the same time, I don't mean that by any means that we're going to be living in steel and plastic buildings sort of removed from nature and creation just because we're relying on high-tech stuff. Notice even today how many people who are techies, they're very high-tech people, but they love organic food, they love getting out on the hike and bike trails, they love being out in the woods, they love camping and hiking and gardening and all that stuff. You know, you can have both, as you well know. In fact, if you're accomplishing a lot, you can have maybe shorter worker hours and can be able to go spend more time outdoors. And if you're able to work out of your own home with your computer or your iPod, whatever, then you don't have to spend time commuting, going anywhere, and spend more time in your backyard and in the woods and the parks. And so I think it's going to be a time when people are going to be very much in love with nature, very much in love with God's creation. But we're going to have huge advantages technologically. There's no reason to not think so. Absolutely no reason not to think so. I want to mention the commutes again. I just think it's heartbreaking how so many of you, so many people, have to spend such a big part of your life commuting, where people are farther and farther from their jobs and the traffic gets slower and slower and we can't build new freeways fast enough to keep up. And that takes a huge chunk of our time. And thankfully, you know, you can be listening to worthwhile things in your car, you know, recorded things in your car. That helps quite a bit. But still, to run the danger of being out on the highway, which is one of the most dangerous things we do, and have so much time taken up, I think in the world tomorrow, we're mostly going, if we go anywhere to work, we'll probably be able to walk to work or ride a bike to work or something like that. And most of the major problems of this life are going to be removed. The fact of the natures of animals being changed is certainly going to be a huge plus. In some parts of the world, a lot of human beings do lose their lives to animal attacks. And just think of the people who lose their lives because of the tiny little creature called a mosquito. And those dangers are going to be removed. And we aren't going to have all those sicknesses and deaths. And many, many people lose livestock and pets to other animals. And without that predatory nature of animals, we won't have to worry about the safety of our livestock and our pets. And when the weather is regulated, and more than one scripture in the Bible talks about rain and dew season. Oh, that will be so wonderful. Not to go from floods to drought, floods to drought, floods to drought, and just get gentle rains when we need it, the right amount that we need in all parts of the world. And some of the parts of the world that are considered just desert, like the Sahara, I just learned recently that much of the Sahara is very fertile, actually. It doesn't look fertile because it just looks like pure sand. But I read that much of it is very fertile. It just needs water. And so when God starts sending water to all parts of the world, what a difference. And then some places are too low, and like swamps, it will be raised up. And when the Bible talks about mountains being brought down low and valleys being raised up, don't panic. That doesn't mean that the world is going to be all flat by any means. But we have too many mountains. You know, many mountains you never get to see. Why? Well, because if you think of a particular mountain, well, there's a mountain in front of that one, but you can't even see that one because there's a mountain in front of that one. And you can't even see that one because there's another mountain in front of that one. And on and on and on. I mean, it's just solid mountains for hundreds and hundreds of miles and all. These huge mountain ranges interfere with the distribution of air and water. For example, in the state of Washington, where we lived for 6 years, people call it the green state. Well, it's green on the western side of the mountains, and it's a desert on the other side, practically. Because the Pacific Ocean air, by the time it gets over the mountains, has already dropped all of its water on the west side. And so to rearrange mountains so that you have a better distribution of air and weather and moisture is going to be a huge blessing. And we can get to the mountains. We won't have mountains in the way interfering with our getting to other mountains. So I think there'll be plenty of mountain sports, but the change in topography. And if we need more land, of course, Christ can just raise up part of the ocean because actually most of the world right now is covered with ocean. And so whenever we need more land, we can always just raise up more ocean and make more land. So, and if you fly across the United States, I'm sure you've all noticed, you fly for miles and miles and miles and you don't see anything. It's like, where are the people? We think of this country as being a populated country, but most of it's not populated. People are congregated in a few large cities mostly. But when all parts of the world become prosperous, and when you can make a good living, and that's the key. I mean, right now you don't want to move out into the middle of New Mexico or Utah because, well, how can I make a living? Well, when all parts are getting rain and all parts are fertile and you can make a living anywhere. And so people can spread out. And we can greatly prosper. And when you think of so-called natural disasters, think of how much money that cost us. Like hurricanes, tornadoes, floods, fires, earthquakes, hail, tsunamis. Think how much money that cost us. And also think of how much money we spend trying to protect ourselves from those things. Think how much money New Orleans has spent building levees and pumps and And they're thankful that they worked pretty well during this last hurricane. But we have to spend a huge amount on those things that we won't have to spend money on in the world tomorrow. Now I want to run down through the Ten Commandments. Because every single one of the Ten Commandments, the fulfilling of it, the obedience to it, is going to have a significant impact on the prosperity of the world. And in a way, this is obvious, but yet let's stop to think about that. With having no false gods, that means no false religion, that means automatic unity, because religion is one of the main things that divides us. And it is going to create a sense of cooperation, unity, and mutual respect, and a humility when people are not thinking, well, it's all about me and I can do this all by myself. When everybody looks up to God and relies on God and puts God first in his life. And number two, the one against using images in the worship of God. Satan has wanted the world to be oriented toward images and pictures and statues and so forth, and has wanted to discourage the world from reading, partly because Satan doesn't want people to read the Bible. But God's religion is a religion based on words, on language. God's people have generally been called the people of the book. And so this world is going to be taught that rather than oversimplifying your religion by building a steeple or a statue and just doing homage to that, you need to get your head in this book and start reading. And forget about symbols that divide us and turn to the book of God, which will unite us. And the principles of the Bible are very practical. The principles of the Bible lead to prosperity. And then number three, about language. I've already mentioned the benefit of having one common language. That is going to be huge. And when no one shows disrespect toward anybody else through derogatory language, when everyone is humble and respectful, and when little boys, and I say little boys because it's interesting how that when girls first talking, they talk in words. When boys first start to talk, it's run, 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 boom, bam, bow, wow, bam. They tend to make sounds, and they say that's one reason why men cuss more than women is because they have a harder time thinking of words. They can't think of words, they just put in sounds. But you know, when the world is taught to have decent, pure, intelligent language, that's going to be a big benefit. And then the Sabbath. When everybody is keeping the Sabbath, no Sabbath conflicts, everybody's going to be resting and rejuvenated and recharged and fired up for God, and draw close to God every Sabbath, and we'll have wonderful Sabbath fellowship, and there'll be so many churches, you know, you don't have to drive to church anymore. You just walk maybe two blocks, and there's your church. Or if you want to visit another church, you walk four blocks to visit another one of your churches. There'll be churches all over the place, and we'll all keep the Sabbath. And we'll be actually more productive that way. You know, that commandment says, work 6 days. Well, people that are not used to working are going to be taught to work, but then they're going to be taught every 7 day to rest. And that's going to make a wonderful difference. And then the fifth commandment about honoring your parents, that means parents are going to take charge and know how to rear their children and love their children, take care of their children, and they're going to realize it's their responsibility to bring up people who are responsible and dedicated and God-fearing and close to God and are wise and are getting educated. And families are going to be close and they're not going to be problem makers. And people couples are going to want to have babies. The Bible clearly predicts there's going to be a population explosion of animals and people in the world tomorrow. We don't have to worry. We're so worried about are we losing some of our animals. The Bible says that the population of animals is going to explode because we're going to enjoy all of them. It's going to be like they're all going to be pets. But the normal thing will be large families. And for any kind of commerce, any kind of economy, what is your greatest resource? People! People are your greatest resource. The more people you have, the more you can get done. The more you can accomplish. The bigger team you have to do things. When all those smart kids grow up, well-educated, what a fantastic world it is going to be. And then number six, no murders, no violent crime. Think of how many good, productive, nice people, the people that would have a lot of potential, their lives are cut short by murder or violent crime. And furthermore, think of how much we spend trying to prevent murders and violent crime and other kinds of crime. And being able to live in peace and not being afraid, no matter where you walk or travel, not being afraid of whether you're going to lose your life. This also means, because of the God family ruling, this also means we won't need police, we won't need investigators, prisons, or lawyers, or legal fees. Think of the astronomical amount of money that every society spends on trying to protect people and prevent crime. But when you have the spirit family, the God family, taking care of all the law enforcement and preventing crime, we won't have to spend money on preventing crime. That's going to be a huge saving. I think of all the wealth that this world has, but how much of the wealth is spent on non-productive things like security and like health problems and like disasters and all that? I mean, it seems like 95% of what we spend money on today won't need to be spent in the world tomorrow. I mean, it's just, with all the natural resources we have and the people, it's going to be amazing. And then the seventh commandment. And I understand Fred gave a good sermon on that last week. And, you know, when we have strong families, we'll have a strong society. And there won't be all the immorality and all the terrible problems that causes in many, many ways. And it's going to be such a blessing for families. For example, no one will engage in any sexual activity until he or she is married, and then they do it after they're married. Simple rule. Not many people following it. And you know, nice thing is that I believe that a new husband is going to be really excited on his wedding night because for the first time in his life, he's going to see a woman's bare breast and other things that people shouldn't be seeing in this day and age. So it's going to be exciting to get married. And just think, no abortions. Think of the people who would be contributing to our society today who are not here, because somebody decided to kill that baby before it was born, and sometimes right after it was born. So that's another reason for the population explosion in the world tomorrow. And then number eight, you shall not steal. One reason we know that God is all for private property, private ownership of property, is this very commandment, you shall not steal. If property that didn't belong to somebody else, you couldn't steal it. I mean, you could just feel, if it was community property, I guess it'd be just as much yours as anybody else. You could take whatever you want. It's community property. But you shall not steal implies that there's going to be a lot of private property and you keep your hands off of it if it's not yours. So no stealing, no cheating. The Bible speaks of every man having his own vine and his own fig tree. Well, that means that vine and that fig tree are on his land that he owns. He owns that vine and that fig tree. And so he can do with it what he wants. And, you know, if you have land and there's no property taxes, no inheritance taxes, no income taxes, no inflation, but you've got land that you totally own, you don't really need much more. With a fairly small piece of land, you can put up a tent or a hut or a little house and have a garden, and you can live on practically what you grew in your garden or your little farm. You know, have a cow, a milk cow, and a few goats. And it wouldn't take much to get by. You won't need a huge income if you just want to get by. But if you want to, you know, start investing your money, maybe buy a little bit more property and have a bigger farm, and you want to start going into the business of for selling stuff to others, of course you can do that. But there's going to be no stealing or destruction of private property, no vandalism. So we're not going to have the fears and insecurity. And when you think about a world where everybody's keeping that commandment, that means we don't need locks, we don't need keys, we don't need security systems, we don't need security cameras. Our minds are free from worry. Oh, what a blessing it's going to be. Number 9, not bearing false witness. To know that everybody's telling the truth. You can believe what people are saying. You don't have to worry about, is somebody lying to me? And not knowing what to believe. And having to draw up a 20-page contract to try to keep him from cheating you. Just a world where you can do business and have relationships without anyone lying to anybody else. It's going to be fantastic. And then number 10, don't covet. That means don't even think about stealing. Don't even get your mind in the wrong place. Don't be trying to get what isn't yours. Don't be lusting. Don't be even thinking about breaking any of the other commandments. And it kind of goes in a circle back to the first commandment, because when you start making something too important, you're making a god out of it. And so in a sense, the commandment, you shall not covet, is more or less saying, don't make a god out of anything. And of course, all will be taught the two great commandments, love God and love your neighbor. We taught the give way of life, not the get way of life, but the give way of life. And I'll turn now to Isaiah 2, beginning in verse 1, which sums up how the world will be blessed with being taught God's laws. In Isaiah 2, beginning in verse 1, now it shall come to pass in the latter days that the mountain of the Eternal's house shall be established on the top of the mountains. In other words, mountains refer to governments, but there'll be one big government on top of above all the other governments. And shall be exalted above the hills, and all nations shall flow to it. And many people shall say, come and let us go up to the mountain of the Eternal, to the house of the God of Jacob. He will teach us his ways, and we will walk in his paths. For out of Zion shall go forth the law and the word of the Lord from Jerusalem. He shall judge between the nations and rebuke many people. They shall beat their swords into plowshares and their spears into pruning hooks. Nation shall not lift up sword against nation, neither shall they learn war any more. When people become lawless, when they become antinomian, when they start becoming lawbreakers, that leads to the destruction of any nation and or to the world as a whole. When the world realizes what are the right laws and agree to them and live by them. And the whole world is law-abiding with right character. It is going to make all the difference in the world. But do you know, much of the world tries to tell us that laws are restrictive. That laws, including God's laws, are a yoke of bondage. That they are confining and restricting. And, of course, if a law is unnecessary or is too complex or is too restrictive, it can be somewhat of a bondage. But let's think about the laws of the Bible. If you took out all of the history and all the prophecy and all the poetry and all that, and you just focus strictly on the laws of the Bible, how big a book would that be? Now, you may think of your Bible as being a fairly big book. But if you took everything else out and you just had laws, that would really be a small book. Now, compare that with one new legislation, one new federal law. It might take as much space as your entire Bible for one law. What I'm saying is, there are not that many laws. Primarily, we have the Big Ten. 10. Not 40,000. 10. Now, most of the other laws of the Bible are extrapolations and extensions of those things. It are applications of those things. You know, we have laws against fornication and adultery and incest and homosexual sex and all that stuff. But they're all sort of applications of the seventh commandment. And we have laws about liability. You know, in other words, if your ox is responsible for goring somebody else, well, then you're responsible. So there's certain practical laws like that. But let me tell you, when God put Adam and Eve in the garden, He said, tend and keep it. Okay, we don't read where they say, well, Lord, tell us how to do it. Where are the instructions on how to do it? I think God just said, well, I created you to be smart. I gave you good brains. And I put a human spirit in your brain. You figure it out. I just want to come back and see a good result. I just want to come back and see it looks nice. So do it. There were no thousands of regulations taught to Adam and Eve about how to do it. But to show you human nature, how human nature always feels like they're deprived, God says to Adam and Eve, you can eat of all the trees in this garden. They're all for you to enjoy. There's only one exception. There's only one tree I don't want you to touch. And they said, where's that? And so, you know, they couldn't be satisfied that they had maybe 500 types of trees that they could eat of. No, they had to go eat of the one tree that they weren't supposed to eat of. And that's the way human nature is, you know, wanting the forbidden fruit. Now, when you read over in 1 Samuel, well, let me read to you what it says in Deuteronomy 6 to show you the blessing the Israelites had when they got to go into the promised land. Deuteronomy 6 and verse 10. So it shall be when the Lord your God brings you into the land of which He swore to your fathers, to Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob, to give you large and beautiful cities, which you did not build, houses full of good things, which you did not fill, hewn out wells, which you did not dig, vineyards and olive trees, which you did not plant. When you have eaten and are full, then beware lest you forget the Eternal your God. God says, I am going to give you a fantastic start. You're going to go in there and you're going to get a fantastic start because you're going to have I'm going to give each family some land and a house that already has furniture, it already has a well, it already has an orchard, already has a vineyard. Now you do your best. Wow. And basically, that's what the prophecies tell us about the world tomorrow. When it says every man's going to have his own vine and his own fig tree, Christ is going to give everybody a good start. He's going to say, look, I've given you the land, the tools, the opportunity, the good brain. Now do your best. See what you can do with it. People are going to get off to a really good start. And the same thing is true at the second resurrection. In fact, I think a lot of what that we're going to have the human people do during the millennium is to build things and manufacture clothing and stuff like furniture and stuff like that to be ready for the billions and billions of people to come up in the second resurrection, so that they, when they come up, they've got clothes, they've got houses to live in, they've got wells, they've got all that they need to get off to a good start at that time. So God will bless people with wonderful starts. But you know, of all the prophecies we read about the world tomorrow under the rule of Jesus Christ, it shows the amazing trust and confidence that God has placed in His creatures. In other words, it's like God says, look, I've made you people with great bodies. In fact, I gave you a body pattern after my body. I have given you great minds. I've put a spirit in your brain so you have a phenomenal mind. Now, I'm going to tell you what the overall goals are, but then I'm going to let you have the pleasure of using your ingenuity and your imagination and your hard work to get it done. To have farms and businesses and industries and inventions and to get things done. Because we don't read in the prophecies about, well, there's going to be this, all these business regulations and industry regulations and environmental regulations and all that kind of stuff. If they didn't need it when they went into the promised land, I don't think we're going to need it in the world tomorrow. I gave a sermon at a feast one time just on freedom, all the different kind of freedoms we're going to have in the world tomorrow. And to me, freedom is a major theme of the Bible. What is the Jubilee about? It's about proclaiming freedom for the world. This is going to be like a continual Jubilee for the world. The world is going to be experience of freedom from problems, freedom from human nature, freedom from Satan and the demons, freedom from poverty, freedom from ignorance, freedom from confusion, freedom from Satan and the demons, freedom to use your imagination and your skills and your talents to maximum ability. Nobody's going to be holding you back. Nobody's going to be sitting on you. Of course, I'm talking about the human beings, and the joy that we're going to have as spirit beings is going to be making it happen. Saying, well, look at how much fun those people are having down there. You know, I provided them this opportunity. I provided them this opportunity. Now we're sitting back and look at the fascinating things that are happening. Look what all these people are doing. Look what they're inventing. Look what they're accomplishing. It's going to be a thrill to us. Now, of course, we read in Isaiah 30, you know, if they start to do something evil, they start to do something sinful, they start to do something that's breaking the Ten Commandments, we step in and say, no, you don't. Don't do anything evil. No. Can't go that way. So we're going to keep them on track in that way. But if they're not doing something wrong, we might think, oh, well, you know, he's doing something. I just know that's not going to work very well. It just never worked in the past. It's not very scientific. But probably we're just going to let him go ahead and find out for himself. You know, rather than micromanaging what everybody's doing, I don't think we're going to micromanage. It's like, we'll let people learn by their mistakes. And they should be learning from one another and looking up history and see who tried that in the past. And if it didn't work in the past, it's probably not going to work now. And all. Let me give you another example of this freedom. Let me remind you of two parables. Over in Matthew 25 is the parable of the talents. A very similar parable is in Luke 19. We might call that the parable of the minas. In both parables, the Lord, the Master, gave his servants so much money. And he says, okay, take this and go make more money. Now, he was really pleased with those who came back and they'd made a profit. And he was very displeased with the one that just sat on it and didn't do anything, didn't even invest it in the bank, not even in a savings account, didn't make any interest on it. He was very displeased with that lack of effort, that fearfulness, like, oh, I'm afraid I might lose something, so I'm afraid to risk anything. Well, let me remind you something that we don't usually mention. Jesus did not say that the Lord told them how to do it. The Master did not tell them, okay, now let me spell out 25 steps for you to follow to make a profit. It's just not there. The implication is, he said, I'm not going to tell you how to do it. That's up to you to decide. I just want you to look around, research, figure it out, see what you can do with your knowledge, your talent, your opportunities. Do the best you can. Because God's not that concerned about what we choose to do for a career or how we choose to invest our money and things like that. But He wants to see that we have godly attitudes and we're going about things in a godly way. But we're really trying to produce in life. We're trying to accomplish. And one reason we're trying to accomplish and grow, even financially, is so we can give to others. That's one of the greatest blessings of having more than what you actually need. And you know, that's one of the sad things about the world today is when you're in extreme poverty, you are on the survival level. It's almost all your thoughts, all your waking thoughts are, how do I make it through this day? You know, how do I get enough food for myself and my babies, and how do I survive? But when you have enough supply, when you're relying upon God, you know, because you're praying every day like Jesus said, give us this day our daily bread. You're looking to God to supply your bread every day, but you're also going out on those 6 days of the week and you are working. You're putting in a lot of work on those 6 days, but then you're also resting on the seventh day. You're not doing any work on the seventh day. Then when you start having your needs fulfilled, then you can start thinking about other people. And you can start thinking more about God. Now, what is it? Tevye and that musical Fiddler on the Roof. Now, we don't expect you to end up like he was singing about. You know, he said, if I were a rich man, all day long I would just be sitting and reading the scriptures and praising you and all that. In other words, he was sort of like he's trying to bribe God by saying, boy, if you just make me rich, I'll spend all day, every day, just reading your scriptures and praying to you. Well, God doesn't want us to go that far. But you know, if you're not rich, but you're not real poor, you can certainly spend more time thinking about God than about other people and serving other people. And you can really practice the give way of life and all of those things. And so it truly will be a wonderful time. You know, the three great freedoms of life are life, liberty, and property. That's, you know, our Declaration of Independence here in the United States got it right. That these are rights given by God, not by people or by governments. And government can't give us any rights. They can certainly take them away. And it's been a struggle for 6,000 years trying to hang on to the rights that God gave human beings. And He wants us to have the freedom to live and the freedom to make our own decisions. Because remember, He said, I give you choices. I show you the way to life and the way to death. I show you good and evil. Now you choose. See, He wants us to be free moral agents. He wants us to have liberty. And as part of God's plan, ideally, to let each man have some property. You know, on the one hand, the Bible says God owns everything. So He owns the whole world. He owns the planet. But He likes to sort of sublet or sublease it to us human beings so that we can feel like we have our own land. So we can say, this is my property. Now, in one sense, we're the stewards over this little part of the property that God is letting us use. But it's a joy that God does let us have property to use. And the whole economy, the whole world functions much better when each family can have a little bit of property. And that's going to be what we're going to have in the world tomorrow. You know, the prophecy in Micah says, every man will have to sit under his own vine and under his own fig tree, and none will make them afraid, including a tax collector. There won't be property taxes, income taxes, and there won't be inflation. I was a teenager in the 1950s and got an email recently about what the prices, typical prices for things were back in the 1950s, and I couldn't remember what they were, but it boggles my mind. The matinee theater was 9 cents. The full feature movie in the evening was 20 or 25 cents. Gasoline was like a quarter a gallon. And I just mentioned these because that constantly eats away. You know, governments, when they run out of money, they can't get enough from taxes, they just start printing more money. And that makes everything go up in price. And that means you can buy less and less with what you have. But we're not going to have all those things, you know, robbing us in the world tomorrow. It'll truly be, and there's no human government that can get close to it. You know, even if new leaders make some changes for the better, I think our country is too far gone for any human beings to save it. I think all we can do is kind of put it off for a little bit, you know, kind of back off and delay the collapse. And of course, I hope that if we need a delay for God's work, that God will delay the collapse. But it's coming someday. But the thing that can give us joy every day is thinking about that Christ is soon going to return to the earth. And we're going to have the awesome, awesome, awesome responsibility of assisting Jesus Christ in ruling the world. We're going to have so much to learn, but what God wants us to do is just try to learn this book right now. He's, you know, learn His Word now, and then He'll teach us all the rest later on. You know, it's kind of like some companies when they're hiring somebody, they say, well, I know you don't know the technology of our country, our company. I know you don't know specifically how to do the job on this job, but we're looking for people with character that we can trust, that can communicate well, that have good character, people that we can trust their integrity, people that are eager to learn, people that have good minds. And if we find somebody like that, then we can train them. Well, that's the way Christ is. You know, it's like, well, I know you don't know much about ruling the world or being a priest or a king, but if you have the character, the godly character, Well, that's what I want. And I'll change you from human to spirit, and then I will teach you how to join me in ruling this world. And it's going to have so many benefits, but one of those great, great benefits is fantastic prosperity.